And now I would like to introduce our two main speakers for the evening. Something special tonight. We have Peggy and Stuart from La Mesa.
Wow. My name is Peggy, and I am an alcoholic. And tonight you are treated to myself and my husband, who we got sober together. We drank together and got sober together. So we're going to sort of give a little bit of a view of what it was like from both of our perspectives. I'll give mine and he'll give his. Yeah. So what it was like, I met my husband when I was a bartender, and he was a customer, and I had just finished college and was working in a bar, which, you know, I hope my son who goes to college next year uses his program and doesn't work in a bar, but that's what I was doing. And I met Stuart, and we partied. I mean, that was a point in my life where I was about, I don't know, I was 20, no, I was older than that. I was around 24, 25, something like that. Anyway, and we had met, and drinking was still a whole lot of fun. Going out to bars, you know, a whole group of people, just the whole activity was constantly drinking, partying, staying up late, no responsibilities, and it was fun. I can't really remember having any consequences given to anything I did when I was drinking. You know, I'd drive drunk all the time. I never got in an accident that I know of. I've never killed anyone that I know of. Cops would pull me over and let me off. You know, I don't get it, but for some reason, I never killed anybody, and for that, today I'm very grateful. But, you know, that's what it was like. There were no consequences. My family of origin was a family that, you know, drinking was just our social life, and it was part of the whole family upbringing, and, you know, I was sort of from a rural place, and so, you know, we'd drive around with riders all the time, which was just a way to say, you know, you're drinking beer, drinking and driving. It's a rider, though, so it's okay. So drinking was really, really normal for me. That whole lifestyle was normal. So, and I clicked with this guy over here. We clicked. We had a really good time. No consequences. And then things got more serious, and we ended up getting married. And actually, Stuart was my second alcoholic that I married. And just as when I met him, I had just left my first alcoholic marriage, and I clearly needed another one because I wasn't done yet. And I met Stu. So anyway, you know, we moved in together shortly after we played with each other and goofed around. And we ended up in Tucson, Arizona, and that's where Stu's job brought him. And he's from Scotland, I'm Canadian, and, you know, we ended up in Tucson, of all places. And, you know, we were still doing a lot of drinking then. We still didn't have a lot of consequences, at least I didn't. And we ended up, after a year there, we ended up coming here. Well, you know, we got married, still partying, you know, still getting to know people early here, but partying like crazy, and had kids. And I was about 35 when I had my first child. And, you know, I knew that I couldn't continue the behavior that I had been doing after the birth of my kid. I knew that. So my drinking really regulated. My party life really regulated. I became at that point sort of like a binge drinker. I wouldn't drink for 9 months, and then, you know, I'd have the baby and, you know, all bets were off. And then I had another child a couple years later. And it was round about that time that drinking started to catch up with us. And, you know, the time, you know, for me anyway, that I really remember is when we were, you know, having such a good time and partying away. And we didn't have a care in the world, and we did not know each other. I knew for myself that, you know, there was something that connected me, but I didn't know who I was, let alone who he was, let alone what we were. I didn't have a clue. But for some reason, we were still, you know, still together, still having a good time. But when the kids came, everything for me changed. I became, I had a lot more fear. I was scared of my behavior, unable to stop a lot of it, and really frightened because I knew I had to bring these kids up. And they were, oh my God, they were my joy. And a lot, so, you know, just the whole stress of having kids and changing jobs and moving cities and blah-de-blah-de-blah. And we're still drinking. And there's not a lot of communication going on from me to him. I'm not communicating much. We're just sort of, you know, in the loop, doing the deal, without a lot of thought. And there came a day when the kids were you know, 3 and 1 or something like that, when Stuart got sober. And it was a shock that that we were alcoholics. I mean, I really didn't know. I thought this was really the normal place to be, the normal mode of behavior. I really didn't know. I was that arrested in my development. I was like a teenager. You know, I sure did look grown up, but I was back there in mid-teens, and that's how my psyche operated. And so I didn't, I forget where I was. Anyway, we had the kids. I had the kids. We had the kids. And, we were alcoholics. Stuart came home and said, "Well, I know what all the problem is. I'm an alcoholic." And I was very puzzled by this. I thought, "Well, you're an alcoholic. And what does that make me?" So I didn't really want to hear that very much, but and so Stu went to get help, and he went to AA, and he started doing a whole lot of things, and I was stuck. I stopped drinking, but I was dry. I was not in a program. So I went to Al-Anon, and that was that was a great place for me to whine and complain. And I thank God I went there, because they told me in Al-Anon that I needed to give it a year, because I was going to be gone. I was the geographic, like many of you are, I know. I was ready just to take off, you know. And I wasn't, because I had these kids. So that sort of bound me too, in my mind, financially. So he's all happy, and we're going to this couples in counseling group at a local our HMO, and to be part of this group, there were two therapists leading the group, and to be part of the group, one partner had to be you know, in a 12-step program, the other had to be not drinking or doing whatever it was that the substance was. So when they, you know, I thought, he wanted to go to this place, so I'm going along and, you know, drumming my fingers. There's about 4 or 5 different couples. And it's pretty gut-level stuff to be confronted in that small space, you know, that intensely, that early. For me, anyway, it was. And so when one of the therapists said, you know, the deal is you can't do anything while you're in here, even if you're not, you know, an alcoholic, I smiled and went, "Oh, it's no problem." And I was just dying inside. I was dying. I was scared to death. I was pissed. I was so angry that he was making me not. It was his fault, and I was there, and I had to do all this stuff. And so that was, for me, part of my journey to my bottom, to get me here. Was that I spent the next year battling in my head and saying to myself, "Oh no, I'm not an alcoholic. Oh yes, maybe I am. Oh no, I'm not." I swear I didn't spend one peaceful minute that entire year, because I kept arguing inside of my head. You know, and clearly, I mean, clearly, that's just not normal. But, you know, I didn't see that. And finally coming to Stu's first year when he took a cake. So he goes off and he gets his cake and he's happy. Happy, happy, happy. And I am really, really angry. And I'm not drinking and I've got this pasted smile on my face and everything's fine. And it was on that day that I went to my first, the day he got his cake was, it's also my birthday, and I went on, I went to my first AA meeting, Lemon Grove Alano Club. There were four of us there, and I had the most sobriety, but, well, I'd been dry the longest, but I wasn't sober. And so we share a birthday now with a year apart. And, you know, then things got really interesting because there was, you know, I have to say for about 5 years after that, for me, my feelings, you know, having admitted that I was powerless and having started to go to meetings, and I was still stuck in just that total victim place. It's all his fault. It's all their fault. It's all its fault. It's all mom's fault. It's all dad's fault. It's, you know, it's the kids. It's this, it's that. And I was there for a long, long time. And I guess it just, you know, I had to be there. You know, that it was, that's just what it was going to take. And because of my behavior at that point, because I was really stuck in my own self-pity, critical little head, I didn't have anything to give to the relationship. Not a whole lot. And I think, you know, round about our mid-sobriety, that was probably about the hardest time for me in our marriage. And I'm amazed. I'm so amazed that we're still together. I can't believe it, because I was ready to just dump it all. You know, I was ready to let it go. It was too painful. It was too painful to confront all of my issues. And there's the person, right? He's my mirror. You know, I'm looking at him and I'm seeing myself. And I'm mad at him. And I, you know, it was so confusing. And So he said, you know, we should get into counseling. Stu's always got these great ideas. And, you know, I resisted. And, you know, I'm really into doing anything in the program. I've done a lot of different things. I'll go to any length to stay sober. I'll go to any length to stay abstinent because I'm in another 12-step program. I'll go to any length to do whatever I need to do to keep my sobriety. And so, you know, I've done, you know, I believe in whatever, counseling, whatever my sponsor leads me to or you all lead me to, I'll go do it. And so anyway, we thought the couples would be good. And so, you know, I knew, I'd been to go into counselors for ages. And I thought, oh, shit. You know, I can bullshit a counselor if I go in there by myself. I can, you know, I can come out of there and not really have been as honest as maybe it would be, helpful for me. So going in together was really, really scary. And so we went, and, you know, I knew this was going to be a long-term thing. I knew we were going to be in there for a while. And my judgment, my impression of my husband, and he may not agree with this, but my impression was that, you know, he thought I'd get fixed and then we'd be out in a few weeks. And I'm sure I thought, you know, the same thing. This would fix him up and I'd have someone to side with me. And then, you know, we'd off we'd go and I'd still be able to get my way. And that's not what happened. 3 years later, you know, I mean, we went every week just about for quite a long time. And it was excruciating. And it wasn't excruciating because of him. It was my insides. They were just ripped. You know, I didn't know how to treat him. I didn't know how to do that. You know, one of my character defects, and one of the things that I learned really well as a youngster was shame. And so I carried a lot of that, and I really knew how to, you know, deal it, and I could deal it really, really well. And that was one of the ways that I would try to control my husband and try to control things in my life to make me comfortable, was to shame them. And, you know, to come face to face with that ugliness, you know, that character defect, was very, very difficult. And then to do it week after week. And one of the things that was really, really helpful, and one of the things that I've learned here, and I've seen it over and over, is that there's always someone who has walked before me. There's always someone who has had the exact same experience. And that's what I started to look for. I started to look for parents, really. You know, what would a parent do? Because I really was a kid. And one of the ways in counseling that was very, very helpful for us was that, you know, it was modeled for me how to talk to my husband. I didn't know how to talk. I didn't know how to respect him. I did not know how to speak to him respectfully, because it was always tinged with something, some sort of manipulative thought on my part. So I learned how to do that, you know. I also learned in another place that I went, I learned how to ask for what I want and know that I may not get it, and that was okay. I never knew how to ask for what I wanted. I just didn't know. I just thought, I'll whine. You know, I'll whine, I'll complain, I'll bitch. And that was huge. One of the things that happened during this process we weren't just at couples counseling. I had a counselor. We were at 55 meetings a week. You know, I mean, it was like we were doing a lot. And one of the things that my husband always wanted was a dog. And I didn't want a dog. I did not want a dog. You know, I had two kids, and in my mind, a dog was going to be another huge responsibility. And my husband wanted one, and he was out of town probably 2 months of the year. So I was not happy about this. However, we have a dog. We did get a dog. And what I didn't understand, and what I learned in here, was that he could get a dog, and I didn't have to take it on. I thought I had to take everything on. I thought everything that came in the door of our front house, or any thought that came into his head or my kid's head or anybody else's head, I was the one who had to take care of it. And I realized, you know, I can't even remember exactly when this happened, that he could get what he wanted, and so could I. Because all I had to do was say, go get a dog, honey. You know, and gosh, when you go away, what are you going to do with the dog? And, oh, well, I'll do this, this, and this. Oh, okay. You know, I mean, talk about keep it simple. That is so simple. I had no model for that. And, you know, that was just a huge door, a huge healing for me, to know that I could stand up for myself in a way that was honorable and loving and kind and still not get what I want. And, you know, for someone like me who wants everything, that's pretty good. And so throughout that process, once we got through that really clump of 5 years, things have really changed for me in my relationship. And I show up today as a wife, as a friend, as a lover. I didn't know anything about intimacy. I'm not going to talk about sex here, but I'll tell you, you know, I don't know. You know, I just... Sex and intimacy to me were one thing, and it was all about some guy wanting something from me. And to have to live in a relationship with that much angst internally and then be intimate with that person when the trust is evaporated for whatever reason is pretty it's difficult. And I could not ever have done it without the support of the people who have already gone ahead in this program, and certainly my higher power. I remember the day Stu came home and said he was an alcoholic, and I remember just feeling my life crumbling. And I went outside and I sat down and I said, I don't know what's happening. I said, I can't believe that I was given these two incredibly beautiful kids, and just to have a broken family. And I swear a hand gripped my shoulder, and it was such a strong feeling that I turned around. Of course, nothing was there. And to me, that was, you know, that was the program saying, you know, just give it some time, just give it some time. And it just has taken time. And so if you're new, and if you are a person who is in a relationship, because it doesn't necessarily it can be any relationship, you know, just seek out those people, you know, that have been there before you, and just keep it simple, and just keep it for today. Because we now have two teenagers, and, you know, keeping it for today is really good when you have kids who are, you know, got their own deals going on. And I wouldn't trade Stu for anything. I'm so grateful. Not even a dog, but I am so grateful that our higher power somehow kept us together, because the promises work. And now I'm going to let Stu talk. Thanks so much.
Stuart Alcoholic. That was really good. What a hard act to follow. Wow, it fills my heart to see so many smiling faces out there on a Saturday night. And if you're an alcoholic like me, Saturday night was the night to get out there. And by this time on a Saturday night, I was well on my way to a blackout. So, you know, it's good to be here and it's good to be sober, because my natural state on a Saturday night, and Friday and Thursday and other nights too. Those of you who know me, my accent gets a wee bit thick when I'm nervous and anxious. And so hopefully by the end of half an hour, I'll be talking like an American. You know, I was out running with that dog a while ago, and we got out running in the morning, me and Maggie, and we're on Mariposa, running by this house on La Mesa, and this guy's coming out to get his newspaper or whatever. It's like 5:30 in the morning, and his dog comes careening out towards me and Maggie, my dog, and I turn on him, and I'm, you know, really afraid, and I go, "Jesus Christ, pal, can you not get control of that wally dog?" And his eyes widen like this. And he's got the dog by this time, he's backing off slowly. The Scottish terrorists have arrived in Love Mesa. I don't even know what a wally dog is. It was something my grandmother used to say. I have no idea what it means. So anyway, this accent though, you know, when I was over in Scotland, a working class Scottish accent didn't serve you too well. My sister was sent to elocution lessons to get rid of her accent, and we luckily the folks ran out of money before I had to go, so I didn't get it. But what was a liability over there turned out, like in the bars with some women, to be actually quite a benefit. And so I kind of learned how to turn it on. I don't do that anymore, honey.
No.
So Peg was talking about that bar we met in, right? And this is in London, Ontario. And I'm working at the university in there, and she's working down the bar. And what she didn't tell you about her first husband is that he's Scottish also. She's got a bit of an addiction for Scotsmen, I think. I hope there's no more Scotsmen in the house here, otherwise I might be in trouble. So, you know, for one of the first times in my North American experience, my accent wasn't working on someone, you know. And she said to me many years later, quite a few years into sobriety, that she saw something in me that wasn't about the accent, you know. Because I was going for the, you know, using everything that I could. And she saw beneath that, she saw something else in me. And I don't know what that was, you know, I don't know what it is. And it got lost somewhere in the drinking as well. And she told me that, you know, it got completely lost in the drinking. And she told me, you know, a few years into sobriety that she saw it coming back, you know. And that really filled me with just the warm fuzzies, you know. You know, there's something about that. And there's I can't explain that. And there's so much in this program that I really can't explain it. But let me tell you a little bit then about, you know, how it was and then what happened and where we are now. And I also want to say, when Terry asked me to do this, I said, wouldn't it be fun to maybe have Peg get involved in this as well? And there's a reason for that. When I first got into this program, I got into this program to save my marriage and to save my job, because both of them were possibly going to go away because of things that I'd been doing when I was drinking. And I was over at Kelton, which was my home group for a long time. And at that time, there was like about four guys going through divorces and stuff like that, you know. And I'm sitting in this meeting, and I'm down at Kaiser as well. And there's a bunch of guys getting, and relationships are falling apart, you know. And I says to my sponsor at the time, find me someone in AA who has a long-term relationship. And he thinks, okay. And he thinks, I can't think of anyone. Now, I know there's people out there, because I see them there who have long-term relationships. But for the new people here, if you're here to save your marriage, forget it. Okay? And long-term relationships are possible through sobriety. You know. And so I didn't hear that when I was here at first. And I got quite anxious, because I saw all these guys divorcing. They were quite happy about it, actually, some of them. But they were divorcing their women. And I was quite disconcerted. It didn't seem like it was a likely thing to happen, you know. And Peg said to me on a number of occasions on that first year that she so eloquently talked about, that she was ready to leave. And sometime about I don't know when it was, maybe about 4 or 5 months. I didn't believe her, right? I didn't believe her. And about 4 or 5 months into sobriety, she said that to me. You know, I could leave at any time, and I got it. And something happened then for me. You know, something happened because I said to myself, that's okay, you can go. It's going to hurt like hell, but you can leave, you know. And when I recognized that, I recognized also that I was beginning to come to the meetings for me, you know. And you've heard about this in this program, those of you who have been around the rooms for a while. You can't come to these meetings to save a marriage. You can't come to these meetings to save a job. You've got to be here for yourself. Because once you're working on yourself, you know, that's the important part. The rest may follow, and it may not. You know, and for us it follows, you know, and we're now, what we're talking about, 25 years now we're talking about. So let me tell you a little bit about how it was in Scotland. Scotland is a, let me tell you a joke. Is my Irish friend John here? He's not here today, okay, because he started with a joke, and he said, you know, he says to me, you've got to tell a joke to kind of warm them up. So there's this alcoholic Scotsman, right, and he's in Glasgow, and he's going through the Sunday papers. And he sees an advertisement, and the advertisement says, drink Canada dry, so he emigrates. Sorry. Canada is a great place to drink, so anywhere is a great place to drink. But Scotland is has a particularly robust drinking culture. And, you know, I was in the 50s, I was born in the late 50s, and at that time, it was common for, in fact, you were told, science told us that mother's milk wasn't that good, and there's a lot of bottle feeding at that time. And apparently I was a very colicky baby, and my mum, on the advice of my grandmother, would put Scotch whiskey into my milk when I was an infant just to calm me down. And yes, it certainly did calm me down. And a few years later, when I first had my first single malt Scotch whiskey, I went, I've come home, this is great, this is wonderful. But, you know, so I started drinking at a very, very early age. But it wasn't till later at school that, you know, I really started getting into the drink. And for me, it was about belonging. It was about being part of. And I know I'm not different from a lot of you here. And I always felt I didn't fit in. I wasn't quite right. And then I'd go down the pub with my pals, you know, and we'd go down and we'd have a few pints. And the tradition in Scotland at that time, and I think it's the same, I'm not sure, is that you'd go and you'd buy a round. So if you go out with six, seven guys, you'd all buy a round. So you're all going to drink, you know, at least 6 or 7 pints of beer on that particular night. And these are imperial pints. This is a big pint of beer. And if you go out with a dozen guys, you're going to be drinking a dozen pints of beer. So you learn to drink a lot of beer very quickly. And if you're not drinking beer, if you're a wimp, you can switch to the wee whiskies, you know. So this is the common culture. And so drinking very, very quickly. And of course, the pubs would close. At that time, they closed at 11 o'clock at night. And so we'd get there at 7, and we're talking about, you know, in a 4-hour period, drinking maybe 24 beers. So you learn to drink exceptionally large quantities of beer exceptionally quickly. And black out, basically, you know, and that's how I learned to drink. But for me, it was about the drink because I liked the feeling, but it was really about the camaraderie. And I grew up with my pals from school, and I felt like I was part of something bigger than myself. That, you know, and these guys liked me, and so I sort of found my home, as it were, and I felt very comfortable. We used to go down the pubs at lunchtime. And this, I was at school, and you know, it was a kind of working class school, but everybody at that time in the UK, they all wore uniforms. And there'd be a dozen of us who would go down the pub, and we'd take our blazers off, and we all had exactly the same white shirts and the same grey trousers on, and we took the blazers over the arm, and we'd saunter in the pub and think they didn't know that we were at the local school. This served us anyway, you know. I mean, they didn't really care that much, and the police didn't care that much either. I remember one time I was up in the high street of Paisley at January the 1st in Hogmanay. New Year's, a big celebration, big drinking celebration in Scotland. And we were out there drinking whiskey, and this cop comes up, this policeman comes up, and he says, "Boys, what have you got in that bag?" And we went, "Oh, dear." And so we handed it to him, and he says, "This is whiskey, isn't it? You know you're not supposed to be drinking whiskey outside." And we went, "Aye." And he goes, opens it up. "Oh, it's Black Label." Tips it up like that. "Thanks, boys. Happy New Year." And that's what the police were like in my hometown, you know. So all sorts of encouragement to drink, you know. And I go through university drinking, and, you know, and there was a lot of trouble there. And, you know, I got into some trouble. But I got an opportunity to come over here to America. And I went to Ohio and went to university there. And then it wasn't just drinking, it was drugs as well, you know, and because there weren't too many drugs around where I was growing up. And so I did everything that I could absolutely find, anything that I could find I was doing. I, you know, I managed to do a master's degree in 1 year because I was on speed the whole time. My major professor had a birthday, and we invited him round, and we made magic brownies for him. Now, he didn't do any of that stuff, and he ended up that night in the hospital getting his stomach pumped. Next day, me and my two buddies are up before the dean getting read the riot act. That's all that happened. You know, Peg's talking about, you know, not getting pulled up for your shit, you know, and not getting, becoming made accountable for what you did. Today, you know, I'm a university professor now. Today, you'll be kicked out of the university at least for doing that kind of crap, you know. And we got read the riot act, and then we got sent home, you know, and that was it. Nothing really happened. You know, but then, you know, I you know, talk about doing geographics, you know, so I do a geographic from Scotland to Ohio, and then I do another geographic up to Canada, which is where I met Peg. And we met in the bar, and as she said, it was a lot of fun. We surrounded ourselves with people who drank, you know, and I hear a lot of people tell their stories about they didn't realize, you know, that there were actually people out there that didn't drink, because normality for us is to surround ourselves with people who drink. And I remember when I came down here to the university here, and all my colleagues here, none of them were big drinkers, you know, and I couldn't believe it. They were strange. There was one guy who passed away last year, so I can mention his name, Bob O'Brien. Some of you may know him. And he was one of my colleagues there, and he was an AA, and I didn't trust him. I did not trust him one iota, you know, because he'd come to the parties and he didn't drink, and I was very suspicious of his character. After I got sober, however, you know, he became my confidant. He became the guy who his office I went to and cried, you know, because Peg was shouting at me again, you know, and she was trying to shame me again, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, so you know, we had these incredible parties, you know, and another big party in Scotland is Bobby Burns Night, and that's on January 24th. It's just another excuse for drinking whiskey. But, you know, it's to celebrate Robert Burns, the poet, you know, the guy who made Auld Lang Syne, all those songs. And so I organized a couple of Burns suppers when I was up in Canada. And on the second Burns supper, the first one was a great success. Everyone got miraculously drunk. And the second one, the same thing happened. And on the second Burns supper, a friend of mine was there, a friend of Peggy's and mine's, Leo, was there. And we'd arranged to stay at this house afterwards. And I was crashed out down in the basement. I was blacked out by this time. And I kind of woke up with this kind of thumping in the stairs. And this was Leo trying to find us, and Leo had fallen down the stairs. And then I heard this incredible snoring, what I thought was snoring anyway. I wake up in the morning with this horrible hangover, and there's Leo lying at the bottom of the stairs, and he's snoring, and I can't wake him up, you know. And we're all dressed in the kilts and stuff like that. So I pick him up, and I take him to the emergency room, and he's brain dead by the time we get him there, you know. And, you know, so what do? We throw a wake. You know, basically, you know. And what I want to tell you, my friends, is that that wasn't enough to get me sober. And, I mean, I remember sitting around there having a drink with our friends and going, poor Leo, it could happen to anyone. It didn't get me here. Not until I got into this program you know, that really touched me hard of what happened to Leo, and it still touches me today. And I've made my amends to Leo in a letter that he's never going to read, obviously. But that's the kind of stuff that was happening. We had fun, but there was crap like that happening as well. And we'd be oblivious. I'd be oblivious to it. I'd just be oblivious. Just, you know, one of those things that happened. So, you know, and so I got the job down in Tucson, and we came down to Tucson, and, you know, we parted some more. Let me get to the good part, okay? You know, so we come to San Diego, and the drinking continues, and I'm a blackout drinker, you know, and there's a story in the book of the woman who drinks to blackout, and then she wakes up in the middle of the blackout talking to someone normally. You know the story I'm talking about? That was me as well. You know, people who, you know, picks one, yeah, that was you. People would be talking to me normally. And maybe it was just the accent, they didn't understand me, I don't know, because the accent is even thicker when I was drinking, you know. But I would wake up from a blackout having a conversation with someone, and they had no idea that I was drunk, let alone blacked out. And that was continuing to happen to me. And I thought that was normal. I didn't think anything. I had no idea what AA was about. Back in Scotland, I had some cousins who were, as I look back now, probably alcoholics. But it was, nobody talked about that stuff. You know, it was the closet, you know, the skeletons in the closet. And no one would admit to it. Oh yeah, your cousin Andy likes his whiskey, Stuart. But that was as far as it got, you know. And I had no idea what AA is. It's not that big in Europe either. I go over there a lot now, and it takes a lot of effort to find AA meetings. And we are really blessed here in San Diego, my friends. Really blessed at the number of meetings we have, and particularly around the La Mesa area, you know. So anyway, so we get here, and you know, we're partying some more, and I'm getting into more and more trouble and doing more and more kind of ridiculous, stupid things. And then, you know, it was 14 years ago, we had a party at the end of the semester, and I got blacked out, miraculously drunk, did some things I shouldn't have done. And the next day, I got home somehow. I don't remember getting home, and I wake up the next morning, and it's like a dream. I had this terrible, horrible dream, and then I'm sure some of you have experienced this kind of thing. As you begin to become compos mentis a wee bit, you realize, well, maybe it wasn't a dream, you know. And I realized the things that I'd done that I could vaguely remember from the night before. And then I connected with some other people, and yeah, it wasn't a dream, and I'd done all these things. And so that weekend, I was just in despair, you know, because that's it, the job's down the tubes. And I told Peg what happened, and she wasn't too pleased. And I figured, well, the marriage is down the tubes. And I'm under our dining room table. I'm curled up almost like a fetus. And I'm just, you know, I'm thinking, well, maybe I'm thinking about throwing that rope over the garage rafters, you know, but I know I'm too chicken to do that kind of thing. And Peg looks under the table, and she looks at me, and she goes, Stuart, you need to get some help. And you know, my friends, for the first time in my life, I heard someone say some words about me getting help. Because I was brought up by a dad who was very stoic, very unemotional, and you looked after yourself. You did not ask for help from anyone, because if you got help, that made you dependent on them. So I never asked for help. You know, I was always in control, so I thought, you know. And, you know, and then the context of Leo dying and stuff like that, it was all, you know, I'd wash it away, I'd put it on the back boiler, because I was always in control of my destiny. And for the first time in my life, I heard Peg say, you need to get some help. So we called up the Kaiser, and I didn't know this, but they have an emergency psychiatrist on ER. I never knew they had things like that at all. And we go down there to ER, and there's this woman there. She says, do you think you might have a problem with drink? And I'm sitting in there by myself, and I'm crying and all the rest of it. And I said, yeah, maybe I do. And I'd never thought that at all. I just thought I was a really, really problematic drinker. I mean, more than problem. You know, I was a cultural drinker. You know, I didn't think I had a major problem. I certainly wasn't an alcoholic. And, you know, it's part of my culture, you know, it's just part of my culture. And because I surrounded myself with people who drank like me for the most part, you know, I thought this was quite normal. But she says, you know, given what you've told me, maybe you have a problem drinking. Do you want to go to, do you want to get involved? This is Kaiser. Do you want to get involved with the outpatients program? And I said, yeah, that might be a good thing to do. So that didn't happen until the Monday. She says, do you want to go to an AA meeting tonight? And I said, aye, okay, sign me up. And she called up. And there was an AA meeting at Kelton at 7:30 that night. So Peg's outside and she drives. I don't know if the kids were with us, but we get the kids and we go to the Chuck E. Cheese over here in Grossmont. And we go there quite a lot when the kids were young, you know, because we can have pizza and beer. And so Peg goes and she gets us a pizza and brings over a pitcher of beer. And I says, honey, I'm going to an AA meeting. I can't drink beer. Guess who drank the beer that night? So I go to Kelton, you know, and I hated it. It was horrible, you know. And then everyone held hands at the end and did the Lord's Prayer. And I thought, this is some kind of Baptist revival meeting. I'm having nothing of this. But I was desperate, you know. I was desperate and I was down. And they told me at Kaiser, try some other meetings. And I tried some other meetings. And then about 30 days later, and I know some of you know this story because it's an important part in my sobriety, I go back to Kelton. And a guy called Jim Starr, who passed away just in December, held out his hand and said, you're Stuart, aren't you? You know. And I didn't know we had greeters and people who actually tried to remember people's names. I had no idea that this was actually some devious plot in AA, you know. I just went, Jim, does this guy remember my name? This is really cool, you know. And then I had another guy, Mark, says to me, don't worry about the God thing, just you know, take what you need and leave the rest. And Mark is one of the most spiritual people that I know today, and he is spiritual enough to tell me to forget about the God thing, don't worry about it, you know. So anyway, I got sober, and you know, Peg kind of told you the rest of the story for that year, and we go to this couples group in Kaiser, you know, and she becomes part of that, and has to stay away from the drink as well, which was hard for her. And then a year later, she goes to an AA meeting, you know, and she realizes she has this disease. And I went, oh, this is my disease. You can't have this disease. So anyway, you know, and so then, I want to say, I meant to say this earlier, our house is full of women in recovery. Peg has a number of meetings in our house, and it's just wonderful. It gets a bit scary, all that female energy. I'm sitting here, and there's these, like, gorgeous women sitting here, and they're just staring at me, and it's kind of intimidating. And I walk into my house, and it's just full of recovery, and it's wonderful, you know. And both Peg and I are busy with a lot of service and a lot of stuff like that. And this is the important part, you know, about what I learned in this program. And I learned this at 4 or 5 months when I learned that I couldn't save my marriage. You know, and what I had to do is I had to come to these meetings for me. And I realized that the more that I come to the meetings, the more that I get back. And the more service that I do without expecting anything back, the more that I get back. And, you know, I was saying to Steve earlier on at the break there, we're having a chat, and I've also problems with my work because I think I'm underappreciated. And the last couple of years I've been doing service at work, you know, and I've just been doing stuff and not looking for more money or any recompense. And damn it, I'm really enjoying work these days. Imagine that, you know, applying the principles of this program outside of the program, and it really works. And so we apply the principles of this program, you know, to our marriage. And I since that time under the table, I ask for help all the time, even for little tiny things, you know, I ask for help all the time. So I got a bunch of guys around about me who are there, you know, to offer me their experience, strength, and hope. And, you know, about, oh, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, we got into counseling. We got into marriage counseling. What Peg didn't tell you is that I started going to marriage counselling on my own. Just me and the counsellor, because Peg wouldn't come. And then we switched to another counsellor, which was closer to where we lived, and she came to that one. But it's really great actually going to marriage counselling just on your own, because you can really bitch and whine about your partner, and they can't defend themselves. I recommend it. Really good. You know, I recommend, you know, doing whatever you can. Relationships are hard work. It's the hardest work that I've ever done. It's harder than any work that I've done at the university. Raising kids is pretty hard too, actually. But the relationship takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of energy. And, you know, what Peg and I have learned is that, you know, as Peg said, you know, we're friends now. I think we've always really been friends. We're lovers, you know, and we're man and wife. And we're not each other's sponsor, you know. And that's a big part of it, because we have our own programs. And we work our own programs. And we spend time here getting healthy so that we can take that health into our relationship and practice the principles of this program, you know, in that relationship. And, you know, we have some amazing kids. And I learned this from Peg, and I'll maybe just finish with this. You know, she said, you know, I'm always worried about teenage rebellion. And I'm sitting in the meetings, and I learn from the men in these meetings, and I learn what they do with their teenagers. I learn what they do with their elder parents, and I get to practice that. Because, you know, as Tracy was saying earlier on, you know, that's a great talk, by the way, thank you. Tracy was saying earlier on, it's a wee program, you know. It's not about me, and we do this together. I can't do this on my own. You know, for my drinking life, I was doing everything on my own, and it was all so screwed up. And I didn't even recognize it. I was so screwed up myself, you know. But it's a wee program, and we get to do things together. And so I learned from men in the program. I listened to them carefully about, you know, I knew my children were going to be teenagers sometime, so I'm listening to those guys when they're teenagers. And you know what? I listened to Peg one day, and she was saying, you know what? If we accept our kids for who they are, they're not going to rebel, because they can't. They can't rebel if you accept them for who they are. And we practice that. And you know what? We've got an 18 and a 15-year-old, and I don't see rebellion in them. And I'm doing stuff with my son now that you know, we go camping together. We go backpacking together. Some guys sitting around here, we've gone backpacking with Ross and me. We've been up in the Yukon canoeing. We go kayaking together. My dad, that stoic old man, you know, he passed away. This is another story that I won't get into now because we're running out of time. But he passed away just before... I hit my bottom, and part of his, you know, him passing away was part of my drinking accelerating. I know that now. But, you know, this stoic Victorian gentleman, you know, he only hugged me once in my life when I was really drunk and I'd been beaten up at the pub. And I came home all bloodied, and I thought I was going to get hell, and he gave me a big hug and said, go to bed, son, and we won't talk about this ever again. You know, and that's the only time my dad ever hugged me. And he always promised to take me fishing, and he never did. You know, he never did. And, you know, but I get to do these things with my son now, you know. And next week, don't tell any of my colleagues this, but I'm taking a few days off work to go to Hawaii because he wants to check out the University of Hawaii in Hilo. And I'm just so tickled that, you know, and, you know, he wants me to be part of his life. And I, you know, I've been sharing this at meetings and crying about my son leaving, you know, because he's going to be heading somewhere in the fall. But, you know, we have this going on, and we have these great kids who are just wonderful and part of us, and they're part of recovery, you know. We share a birthday, Peg and I, and they come along to this one meeting that we go to on a Sunday morning, because there's always cake there, you know. And they've been coming along since they were very wee, and they know recovery, you know, and they know what a healthy relationship is, and they know what a healthy family is. Thank you very much for your attention.